Thank you, Pastor Greg, and welcome to our sixth session on the Bible study this summer on the Bible and science. I want to start off with this verse that I mentioned last week. Now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I will know fully. The third line, now I see in a mirror dimly, now I know in part. That's just a statement of the way things are. That's the status of life this side of heaven. And the atheists certainly agree with us that we don't know everything. We now see in a mirror dimly. Everyone agrees on that. Now, God is making a promise in line 2 and 4 when he says, then face to face, but then I will know fully. Not in this life, but on the other side, in eternity, we're going to know fully. That's God's promise. Now, what evidence do we have that that's true? Well, if your mother says to you, I'll pick you up after school, do you worry about it all day? Gee, I wonder if she's going to show up or not. No, you have confidence, you have assurance, you have conviction that she's going to do that. And why do you do it? Well, maybe once in a while she doesn't make it. Okay, I see he's laughing here. Okay, because you know your mother loves you, and you've known from past history that if she says she's going to be there, she's there. So we have the same assurance with God, but then face to face, then I will know fully. That's God's promise. We know God loves us, and we know he's always been faithful to what he says he will do. So we have that evidence that God will be faithful. Our faith is built upon evidence. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And it's not just an assurance that we have in a vacuum. We have an assurance because God has given us the evidence in the past. And we trust him, and we found him to be reliable, and more than reliable. Now, last week we talked about worldviews and faith. Every worldview is built ultimately on faith. If you push it back far enough, you push them back far enough, there's something you assumed that you couldn't prove, and that becomes the foundation of your worldview. It's a faith statement. Something you assume to be true but remains unproven. Now, that's true for Christians and for atheists or anyone. We all have a worldview, or, you know, how we see the world and how we explain things is our worldview, and that is built ultimately on faith. Whether you're a Christian or whether you're atheist, it's all the same. We all have faith at the basis. And when the atheist says, you just have faith, I have evidence, that absolutely is not true. We both have faith, and we both have evidence. And the question is, where does the evidence put you on which faith is true? And we'll talk about that a little bit as we go on. Something must be eternal and uncreated. We argued that point last week, that if there is anything now, which there evidently is, there must have always been something. If there were ever a point when there was nothing, all we could have today is nothing, because something cannot come from nothing. So something has to be eternal and uncreated. In Christianity, the first few words of the Bible say, in the beginning, God. Okay, that is our faith. That is our assumption, which we don't prove. We take that. The Bible doesn't prove God. It doesn't offer proofs. We don't offer proofs. We assume that to be true, and that's our faith. We're justified by faith. Okay, we're not justified by proving God. We're justified by believing God. Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness. We never have to have faith contrary to the evidence. Absolutely never. If you've been listening to me for the last 5 weeks, you know I'm a big evidence guy. The atheists want to define science, for instance, when we talked about the definition of science. They want to define science as the study of materialistic causes of everything. And they, right from the get-go, rule out any possibility of God. Well, what if there is a God? And what if God did act in nature? That science that eliminates God from the get-go, before you look at the evidence, is never going to find the truth. So I said, let's define science this way. Let's define science as a search for the truth. And we'll follow the evidence wherever it leads us, regardless of the metaphysical implications. Atheism. Within atheism, matter is eternal and must explain everything. The interaction of matter with other matter, according to the laws of nature, wherever the matter came from, wherever the laws came from, they assume those. That's their faith. That must explain everything. For instance, the origin of life. And I keep going back to the origin of life because that is a fundamental question. You can't say, no worldview can say, oh, I don't care about the origin of life. That's a thing. We'll let someone else worry about that. No. The origin of life is central, and it can't be ignored. Everyone has to have some sort of explanation as to how life arose. Obviously, it did. Everyone believes that at one point in the history of the earth, there was no life. Now there is. And how did that happen? We need an explanation. We need an answer for that. And within atheism, the concept of God and justification are irrelevant to them. Does atheism have answers to questions in historical science like the origin of life? Now, historical science, remember when we talked about that? Historical science is studying, looking at something that happened once in the past, not repeatable. The origin of life is an example, or the diversification. How did life diversify into all that we have today? Did it occur by evolution? That's all historical science, and it's speculating from evidence that we have now about what happened once in the past. Experimental science, that's something else, like why the air conditioning isn't working in my car, is not a historical science question, nor does it have any metaphysical implications. That's just a question on experimental science. So experimental science is different from historical science. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. Does atheism have answers to questions in historical science like the origin of life? The atheists themselves say no. We saw Dr. Wall's statement last week when within his atheistic worldview, which says there's no God, now let's try to figure this out. How did it all come about? Within that worldview, when he considered the origin of life, what was he driven to? He was driven to the statement that we choose to believe the impossible, that life arose spontaneously by chance. Okay? When your worldview leads you, and you look at the evidence and leads you to that point, you know there's a problem somewhere. So, which faith is best? The atheist faith, the Christian faith? And how do we know that there is a God? I always think of it this way in my own mind, because this is what I went through many years ago in college. Is God really necessary to explain things? Am I just sort of pasting God over on the top of things where he's not necessary so I can be a nice little Christian kid? That's the question I was asking in college. And my answer, of course, is that the evidence not only allows for God, the evidence demands God. And that's what I'm talking about this summer, how the evidence demands God. And we've got a long ways to go, and you'll see and see many times over why that's true. Okay, the role of evidence. We do not believe in a vacuum with no evidence. Christianity has evidence, overwhelming evidence in our support. Worldviews are built on a belief, a faith statement, as I said a moment ago. In general, then, which faith is best? The one that has the fewest and most reasonable unproven assumptions or brute facts at its foundation, and the one that is best able to explain the evidence. We don't want to have faith in lots of different things that we can't prove. Let's have faith in the minimal number of things that we can't prove. For instance, in the beginning God. And then let's see how that explains the evidence. Now, the objection to that could be, well, yeah, you're positing God because God can do anything. So if, you know, if we can't explain how it happened materialistically, then we'll just put a fig leaf God over our ignorance. And that will, that's how we use God. Is that how we're using God? If that's how we're using God, we're in trouble. We are not using God that way. The evidence, as I said a moment ago, demands God. And that's what I'm talking about this summer, and I'll show you that evidence as we go along. Okay, the scale of faith. Blind, weak, stronger, and strong. We can have different levels of faith in something. And what is that based upon? It's based upon the evidence. If we have no evidence, then it's blind faith. I'm just believing it. I have no evidence for it. That's blind faith. And that's what the atheists really accuse us of having, is blind faith, because they say we don't have any evidence. Well, they don't listen. You know, they don't listen to the argument that the evidence demands God. If we have a little evidence, more evidence, lots of evidence, then our faith goes from weak up to strong. How about Dr. Crick? Now, we talked about this a few weeks ago. He, in considering the origin of life, this idea of directed panspermia. There's an intelligent civilization somewhere, billions of years ago, very advanced, that sent out spaceships with blue-green algae on them all over the world, all over the universe, and seeded the universe, panspermia. So he came up with this idea of directed panspermia, and one of those spaceships landed on Earth, and then that algae evolved into everything else that there is today, and that was his explanation. When the experts, the big guys in your field, start talking about panspermia, you've got problems, okay? There are problems with that because there's no evidence. There's no evidence for it. Dr. Walls, we saw last week his quote, "We choose to believe the impossible." I mean, that's pretty condemning when your worldview puts you in a position where you have to believe the impossible. And I would put those two statements, directed panspermia, deciding to believe the impossible, somewhere to the left of blind faith. Because it's not that they're going on no evidence. It's that they're looking at the evidence and saying, no, I don't believe it. I'm going this way. So that is worse than blind faith. Professing to be wise, they became fools. So seven words constitute Romans 1:22. Professing to be wise, they became fools. These are wise guys. This breaks my heart, actually, that you have such intelligent people, and they're denying the obvious. They're denying that there's a God, and they're ending up with foolishness. Origin of life. How did life begin? Every worldview, as I said, must answer this question. It's not something you can just ignore, like it's not important. It is central. Two options. There's a Christian worldview. In the beginning, God. And God said, let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures and let the birds fly. And God created man in his own image. This is all from the very opening words of the Bible itself. That's our Christian worldview regarding origin of life. Atheistic worldview, matter is eternal and all there is. Earl, there's a little pointer on there. I don't know what that's doing. Matter is eternal and all there is. Life arose spontaneously by chance. And the diversity of life was created by evolution. Those are the tenets of atheism. Life had to arise spontaneously by chance. How else could it do it in a materialistic worldview? How could then, if we get the first living cell, how could that diversify into all that there is today? The process of evolution. Okay, that's their theory. If evolution doesn't work, can they go, well, theory A didn't work, we'll go to theory B. If that doesn't work, we'll go to theory... No, that's the way science would normally work. If the evidence is so condemning to your theory, then you go to a new theory. Where do the atheists have to go? They have nowhere. That's why evolution has to be true. That's why evolution is one of the best established facts in all of science. The proof and the evidence are abundant, as it said in that textbook quote. That's why if you attacked evolution, you're a religious nutcase, because evolution for them has to work. They have nowhere else to go. Evolution has to be true. So that's where they stand. Now, again, we look at the evidence and see, does the evidence of science point to God? Some atheists respond. These are all quotes from atheists. We must constantly keep in mind that what we see was not created but evolved. Now, why do we have to constantly keep that in mind? If it says creator, why do we say there can't be a creator? Let's at least consider the possibility then that there is a creator. If it looks created, let's at least investigate that possibility. Oh, no, no, we can't do that. That's not science. I'm a scientist. That's religion. If you want to talk about God, that's religion. No, what I want to talk about is truth. What is truth? What is true? That's, I mean, if you want to say scientists can't find what's true, that's fine. Then that's your science. My science is what is true. And I will approach that as a biochemist within science. Biology is a study of complicated things that appear to have been designed for a purpose, Dr. Dawkins. Well, if they appear to have been designed for a purpose, why is it then not possible that they were designed for a purpose? Because before you looked at the evidence, you decided there's no God. Now let's figure out how this all came about. The origin of life, Dr. Crick said, almost a miracle. He couldn't say miracle. I mean, he would have been ostracized, even Dr. Crick, if he had said miracle. There can't be miracles within the atheism. So he said, almost a miracle. And then he went on to the panspermia. And Dr. Dawkins, more recently, in talking about panspermia, referred to it as intriguing. Again, it's an argument from no evidence. It's an argument to try to salvage a worldview that is not working. Dawkins, no one knows how life began. And many of them say that. They don't know. There is not an explanation. We choose to believe the impossible, Dr. Wall said, that life arose spontaneously by chance. I can't imagine him saying that. He was a big guy in science, and he knew that, you know, if he made that statement, it was not going to go unnoticed. We choose to believe the impossible, that life arose spontaneously by chance. It's impossible within atheism that life could arise by chance. So where are we on the evidence of science supporting atheism or supporting God? The evidence points to an intelligent source of everything. It points to at least some kind of mind behind it. That's what they'll say when they eventually realize the truth. There must be a mind behind it. Well, we know who that mind is because we have not only general revelation, which I'm talking about in this class, we also have special revelation, God himself. Special revelation tells us who God is. So we know who the mind behind it all is. Okay, Dr. Wall, why did he say impossible? You know, that doesn't usually happen. He gave up all hope. Why not? Why didn't he say, oh, it's improbable? Or we haven't figured it out yet. There are lots of people working on it. Someday we'll get there. Like Huxley said, we're going to eliminate the need for God. Why didn't he take that route? I mean, who's going to argue with him on that point? We haven't figured it out yet. Someday science, and just sort of hold out that little promissory note that someday science will figure it all out. Darwin thought he knew how life arose, or some warm little pond somewhere. He was imagining maybe all the components necessary. He had no idea what the components were, but they were all there. And maybe some electricity or lightning went through it and life arose. And that was the explanation for how life arose, you know, 150, 160 years ago. Today, now, with the progress of science, have we figured it out? No. We've seen it's incredibly more complex than anyone could ever have imagined. Even what we would call the simple cell. There is no simple cell. The simplest possible life form is utterly, extremely complex. And we're still trying to figure out how, you know, what would how it works. We still don't know fully how that all works. So with the progress of science, we've gone from knowing how life created, although it was totally naive and wrong, to saying, we have no idea. God is revealing himself in the discoveries of modern science through math related to complexity. Math is the key to understanding it. And that's why I wanted to get into a little lesson today on math. Math is the key. It's the math that's convincing them. Okay? And I love math. I'm not a mathematician. I love math because of what it can do for me. You know? I don't love it just because it's math, like Dr. Brown or Dr. Guthrie. Okay? So they love math because it's math. Okay? Or Mr. Adams. You love math because it's math. They're math teachers. I love math for very practical reasons, for what it does for me. Okay, I'm very selfish with math, I guess. Okay, so I wanted to have, this is where we are in our topics this summer, the quantitative argument that was today, and I'm about to get to that. And the quantitative argument is going to lead us to God's signature in nature. What is it in our study of nature that points to and demands God? Now, to understand that, there has to be a little math. Now, the math that I'm going to be talking about is nothing you haven't had before. So this is all review. Okay? It's review. Now, you've totally forgotten it because you didn't need it. But now you need it. So let's get it back again. Now, I'm going to say some things about math that I suspect you have never in your life heard. In fact, I'm pretty sure, because I just put this slide together this week. So unless you have access to my computer. But no, these thoughts, I guess I've always thought this, but I've never really put it together quite like this. Math is a gift. Okay, math is a gift to us from God. I don't like to hear people say, oh, I don't like math. If you give someone a gift, and they don't say anything about it, never acknowledge it, that's not nice. If they say to your face, I don't like your gift, that is uncouth. Okay? We don't do that. We don't say to God, I don't like that gift you gave me. Okay? Math is a gift. The gift of math opens doors that are otherwise closed to our understanding. Math allows me to go places that are forbidden to me without the math. Without the math, it doesn't, you just can't go there. You can't figure it out. You can't appreciate it. God gave us the math as a gift. It'll open doors that reveal God's signature in his creation. Math was created by God for his glory. Did he need math? No, he didn't need math. He spoke molecules of it. He gave us the math because he knew someday, science would discover how complex things really were, and we would need the math to really understand that and to quantify it and to see that the origin of life, for instance, is impossible. It's impossible because of the math involved. Math causes us to glorify God in a way we never could without math. Don't you love this stuff? I mean, this is great. We need to get excited about God and his revelation. Math is a vehicle that helps us to praise God and point others to him. Well, how does it do that? Well, if we understand the math behind it, say, look, what is the possibility that hexokinase, which I've shown you many times now, 457 amino acids, 20 different possibilities for each position on that. What is the possibility that could arise by chance? Even if we had all the amino acids to begin with, which we don't in a pre-biological earth, the amino acids don't exist. Maybe a few of them in crude form and lots of other amino acids, but not just the 20 that are involved in biochemistry. Our chief goal is to bring glory to God. It's all about him. And the math is important. So I don't want any negative attitudes about math. Okay. The qualitative argument, the quantitative argument, and is there a probability bound? The qualitative argument is, wow, isn't that wonderful? Look how complex that is. How could that ever have evolved? God must have done it. That is a qualitative argument. And it's true. There's nothing wrong with a qualitative argument. I agree with them. Quantitative argument talks now about probability. What are the mathematics behind this? How could this happen? What if we made one of each of those molecules of 20 amino acid possibilities in 457 positions? How many different hexokinases or size molecules, proteins, could we make? And if you calculate that out, it's like the mass is greater than the mass of the known universe. That's one enzyme that we need out of hundreds in the proposed simplest life form. And not only do we need all of those enzymes, because what good is a cell without its genes? It can live for a little while, but it can't make new little cells, and you know, that's it. It's going to die, and that's the end of it. Okay, let's start all over. Hundreds of amino acids. This time, let's get the genome with it, and let's make sure that these things happen at the same point and at the same time. If the genome develops here, and the rest of the cell happens to evolve over here, what good is that? They've got to be at the same point in the universe and at the same time, or else it's no good. I mean, it just gets more and more remote the more you think about the possibility of life arising by chance. Is there a probability bound? Is there a mathematical point at which we can say the probability of something happening is so remote that we can honestly say never? It would never happen. And I'm going to argue that there is such a point. And the numbers that we're talking about, the math that we're going to see in biochemistry, is so far beyond that point. I mean, we're not even close to that point. It's here. We're orders of magnitude away, many orders. Okay. Here's an eye. Qualitative argument. Look at the intricacy there. I mean, how is the first cell ever going to evolve into something that eventually will have an eye in it? The complexity, the beauty, the ability of it to adjust for different distances, the stereoscopic vision, which allows you to estimate distances. If you try driving with one eye, you may have a little bit of trouble figuring out how far that other car is away from you or how far the pedestrian or whatever. God's given us two eyes, a stereoscopic vision, and our brain can interpret that and give us a relative idea of how far away that is. We can adjust to differences in light. All of these, and the rods and the cones, we're not even showing here the details of the retina. And it's just incredible. And all of this optic nerve, thousands of fibers having to go just to the right place in the brain. How does this happen by chance? Well, it can't. And that's, you know, that's an argument for a creative being, God. Okay. I'm going to do this one thing on math, and then we're going to stop, and we'll pick it up next week. This is a combination lock. It has four little wheels here. Each of them has 10 numbers, 0 through 9. That's 10, right? 10 wheels. Now, how many combinations do we have possible? How about 40 combinations? 10 fours, right? I mean, you got 4, 10 times, so there are 40 combinations to this lock? No. Each wheel gives us 10. So if I put, say, a 1 on the first wheel, I have a 1, a 2, a 3, a 4, a 5, 6, up to, you know, 9, 0. So I have 10 possibilities for number 1. If I put number 2 here, I have 10 possibilities for number 2 on the second wheel. 3, 10 possibilities. So I have 10 groups of 10. So my first two wheels, if I had only two wheels, I'd have 10 groups of 10. There would be 100. So I'm past the 40 already. Forget the 40. The next one, I have now 100 on the first two, so I have 10 more groups here for each one. So I have 100 groups of 10. That's 1,000. So I got 1,000 possibilities on three wheels. My fourth wheel, I give 10 For each of those thousand, it's 10,000. So we're talking about 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 equals 10,000. 10 to the fourth. Okay? Do you notice any similarity between this standard number and this one written in exponent form? 4. Right? Do you see the 4 here? 4 as an exponent. The little number above here is a 4. How many zeros are there here? 4. So if we see 10 to the 4th, that means a 1 with 4 zeros after it. If we see a 10 to the 100, that means a 1 with 100 zeros after it. So what is the probability now if I give you one chance to open this lock? What is the probability that you'll get the right answer? 1 in 10,000. Don't shake your head. It's 1 in 10,000, right? But this is math. This is not qualitative stuff like, No, no. This is math. We know the numbers here. 1 in 10,000. What if I gave you 2? Then it's 2 in 10,000. Why do some people buy lottery tickets, buy multiple lottery tickets? They want to increase their probability of getting the right answer, okay? They want to increase their probabilistic resources, okay? That's a word that will be on the final exam, probabilistic resources. Now, why do I say probabilistic resources is like time? If I give you the lock and say, here, you've got 2 minutes to find the combination. Think you're going to find it? No. What if I say you have 2 months to find the combination? Are you going to find it? Yeah. Time increases your probabilistic resources because it gives you more chances. Now, one of the things that the atheists are going to do and the evolutionists are going to do is throw in millions of years, billions of years to muddy the waters. But the numbers are so overwhelming against life arising by chance that billions of years, I don't care, throw in trillions of years. No one's talking trillions of years. But if you want to throw in trillions of years or 10 trillion, 100, I don't care, throw in a quadrillion years, it's still not going to work. It's not going to be enough time for it to happen. The probabilistic resources of the entire universe, I'll show you the numbers on this, the probabilistic resources of the entire known universe are not sufficient to bring into existence even the simplest conceivable life form. And it's not even close. It's not like, oh, they're almost there. No, they are so far away. And that's why Dr. Wall, do you think he knew the math? Of course he knew the math. And he said, we choose to believe the impossible. Not the improbable, or not the we haven't figured it out yet. He gave up. We choose to believe the impossible. That's where that worldview leads. And I'll show you, I've got a lot of fun stuff to do in the next few weeks, and we'll look at this some more. I'm going to stop there for now.